May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and tonight on the Saturday Night Special, that's what we're talking about. But having a special designated month is not why we're talking about it. We're talking about it because it needs more discussion. Here are the facts. According to data from Mental Health America, the Center for Disease Control, and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one in five Americans have some variety of mental health condition. This is 43.7 million Americans. That's more than the entire population of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin all put together. And one in 25 Americans, or nearly 10 million people, experience some form of severe mental illness at some point that substantially interferes with their daily lives. And looking at state-by-state data, Illinois has the fifth highest rates of mental illness in the U.S., with nearly 1.6 million residents impacted directly. Youth mental health is worsening, too, with rates rising over the last several years and with 80% of those affected having zero or insufficient care. Mental health is a topic that can go a lot of ways, and indeed, it can get very dark. But look, on the heels of the recent high-profile suicides of former NFL player Aaron Hernandez and musician Chris Cornell, and with staggering data around stress and anxiety and mental health, and with, for as much as we thread mental illness through and around so many stories in the news involving violent crime, for all that, and for as much as we are talking about it, one can also argue that we're not talking about it enough, and especially not in the ways that we should. For as openly as we talk about most physical illnesses, mental health is still shrouded in taboo. There's still a sense that if one would just pull himself up by the bootstraps or cheer up or shake it off, he'd be okay. Along with it, a narrative exists that vulnerability and openness is somehow weakness. But look, we wouldn't very well mock someone for admitting they need to see a doctor for, say, having the flu or an earache. In fact, we'd probably encourage them to seek medical attention. So then why is needing help with mental health still met with judgment? While we can enter circular and endless discussion about the notion of policing our language, often identified as the refusal to be, quote-unquote, politically correct, versus being more accepting of others through the words we choose, it all comes down to this. What we've been doing and the way we've been talking about mental health is not helping. And in our constantly connected, overcommitted world filled with grim headlines about atrocities around the world and a rather contentious political climate, these are real topics that we need to address openly, plainly, and quickly. So if being a little more conscious of shifting to slightly more inclusive language could help someone, wouldn't you want it to? We've made strides, to be sure. Thinking back just a few years, the suicide of Robin Williams suddenly had people talking about anxiety and mental illness and suicide in more open ways than ever before. But there's still a way to go. So tonight, we are talking about mental health in the U.S., and while there are many aspects to it for us to acknowledge and to explore, we'll talk about as many of them as we can tonight, and with guests who bring professional and clinical perspective to the conversation, as well as data, perhaps even hope of changing the narrative a bit. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
You heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight and sharing part of your weekend with me. Always grateful to you for doing so. So tonight we're talking about mental health, and I hope that that topic does not scare you away, because it won't be so grim. In fact, we're aiming at lifting the lid off of a far too taboo topic and having pretty constructive conversation, not around the topic, as so often is the case, but right in the topic. As ever, we'll be joined by guests to help us explore different aspects of it.
we'll talk with two clinical mental health professionals about the way we talk about mental health and about recent high-profile suicides. We'll also talk about mental health in the political narrative and with a clinical social worker who supervises a crisis text line and president of the Illinois chapter of Mental Health America. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. Yeah. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one topic and talk about it all evening. And tonight's topic is mental health, because not only is May Mental Health Awareness Month, but also there's a lot of that in the news right now. There's lots of scary and dangerous headlines around us every day because, in fact, scary and dangerous things happen around the world, sometimes right in our own backyard. And a lot of people are stressed out and a lot of things are happening. And a lot of times when we, particularly when we're talking about crime, we tend to mention that the person who has been accused of the crime, in fact, had, we say, mental illness. But we use this very vague term, which is troubling because we talk about physical illness to be very, very specific. You'll say, I had pneumonia for 4 days and then I had bronchitis or whatever. You'll say very, very specific things. But mental illness, I think there's still some taboo around it. The way we talk about it is still a little bit, you know, not only is it taboo, but there's a stigma to it still. So I think there's a tendency to want to kind of brush it aside or downplay or make it vague. So that's what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about many different aspects of it. But as ever, when we ask ourselves what makes people tick, we bring in our good friend, Dr. John Duffy. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Amy, especially tonight.
This is like the thing. This is your, in particular, this is your wheelhouse as we're talking about mental health. And especially the way we talk about it, because this is something you do a lot. You talk about not just mental health, but the way we treat it, the way we think about it, the way we heal, all of those things.
Absolutely. And you know, your intro was so apropos because this stigma around it, you can sense like, please hang in here. This isn't going to be awful. You know, you don't have to worry that, you know, you're going to be infected by it.
Right.
And I think that there's still enormous stigma and taboo around this subject. And the more we talk about it, I think the more we kind of lift that stigma and people feel a little more comfortable. And then you realize, okay, the sufferers aren't alone. You know, and it lifts, you know, some of their depression or anxiety or whatever it is that they're suffering. So, you know, it's no small thing. The lifting the taboo has a ripple effect that can go on and on and on.
Yeah. I mean, I think in recent years it's gotten a little better because I see people that I don't even know particularly well on social media. They'll openly say, I'm so glad I went to therapy today in light of, you know, ahead of this big news coming because I'm in a place where I can take this news or I can handle it, particularly since the election, like such a divisive time politically and still so much contentious stuff as the issues are being discussed that I think people are very stressed out and everyone has a boiling point.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah. And I think you mentioned Robin Williams' suicide. I think that was somehow there was a tipping point there. I think you're right that the election was another tipping point where people felt more comfortable talking about what they were, that they were depressed, that they were anxious, that they were suffering in some
or
in
fearful
some way.
Or
and
something.
Fearful. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a real one, too. And I know there's this. You know, I get caught up on language a lot. I think often about how do we say things, how language evolves to include things or downplay things or sometimes play up things that shouldn't be played up or how we mislabel things. I think about that a lot. I feel like we talk about that every single show, no matter what we're talking about. But it matters so much. I think semantics do matter. And especially in this time when so many people are like, don't hit me with that political correctness. Look, I believe that if you change out the words politically correct with treating people with respect, there you go.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, a lot of times people, not always, but a lot of times when people are arguing for the freedom to say what they want, it is not taking into account that you might be marginalizing a group of people or hurting them or even making things far worse for them.
Exactly. No, I think that's a really good point. And around mental health and especially mental illness, the language we use, especially when we're cavalier. You know, sometimes we're cavalier and we use words like nutty, or we say like, oh, I'm super depressed today. You know, and so we lose the specifics of what these things mean. You know, and it's probably important to speak with some degree of accuracy about mental illness, and to your point, with a deep degree of understanding. That term political correctness always feels like a scapegoat term to me. like it feels like an easy way out. I like the way you reframe that, because you know, if we can look at it as, okay, we're going to speak with the with respect to one another. I think you've got something there.
And especially on this topic where literally lives are at stake.
Yeah.
If we could change the way we talk about mental health, the possibility of more people perhaps reaching out or feeling less isolated, or perhaps I think there's another part of that too, and that's the people around somebody.
Agreed.
A lot of times it's, I didn't want to say anything. I thought it'd be awkward. Well, so what?
Yes, yes. And I think the times, to your point, I think the times are changing with regard to that as well. I think we're talking more about it, and we're giving people permission to talk about the fact that they are suffering in some way. And there's no numbers to tell us how many people's lives have been saved by just being able to talk to somebody instead of thinking, oh, I'm alone here. And, you know, in my profession, I hear that a lot. Like, I think I'm the only one. And I can sit there and tell them, I can promise you, you're not. You know, there will be somebody else here today that probably suffers from the same thing.
Right.
But to hear it, you know, from somebody else who's suffering or from another family means an awful lot. Means more than it might mean coming from a mental health professional.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, even if you look at that in another way, how many friendships have been started over a common grievance?
Right.
You're like, oh my gosh, you can't stand that? I can't stand that either. Right. We're friends now.
Exactly.
I mean, there is power in suddenly feeling like I'm not ridiculous for thinking this.
Absolutely.
But I wonder too about when we're talking about this, when we are feeling isolated, things like that. And I'm going to say we, because we're all human beings here and we all have these moments. Do you get the sense that women and men talk about this differently?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm laughing because absolutely, without a doubt, women and men talk about these things differently. Just looking at, if you could see the traffic in my office or in a typical therapy office, I work with teenagers a lot. Moms bring in teenagers, girls more than boys. There is still this lingering taboo affiliated with mental illness among men and among boys, that this is a weakness, that this is something that you just have to grit through and tough through, and it's shameful in some ways. And I think women are far more advanced about really accepting, like, okay, this is an illness, like diabetes is an illness, and so we're going to problem solve and treat this and, you know, see the right people and come up with a plan. And men are far more resistant to that. I think we're acculturated that way. And so I think there's still work to be done, a lot of it. The good news is I think the younger generation, even of boys and relative to men, is far more sophisticated and advanced than my generation is in talking about this.
That's good news.
Yeah.
I was looking at a lot of data getting ready for the show, and I was really struck by how uneven, when you're looking at suicide data, it's so skewed to men.
Oh, it is.
And which is completely in alignment with what you're saying here.
Sure. Yeah. I think about there was an unfortunate incident in the area where a boy took his life, and I won't be too specific, just out of deference to that family. But it happens frequently where I always feel like, oh, if just there was that moment where somebody stopped him or he stopped and talked to somebody, there might have been a chance, you know? And I think girls take that opportunity far more. I don't think that boys are suffering more. I think that girls just take the opportunity to use the resources around them and to talk.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think when they do, it's probably met with a little more acceptance.
Yes.
I think when you hear men talking that way, often it's, I think in the dominant narrative anyway, I think it's often like he's really messed up. He's full of drama. Mm-hmm. Whereas women are just being women.
Right.
One thing that I have noticed though, and I would say is just anecdotally, I feel like there's a trend among, older professional women, I'm going to say just because we were, I'm saying older just because we were just talking about youth,
yeah.
but, you know, adults, but particularly women who are kind of type A, things like that. I noticed that just because I'm that way and I'm around a lot of women that way, there is a tendency to joke about particularly depression after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, some people I know, we were talking about this very topic, and one of them said, oh my gosh, February in Chicago is so tough, I want to put my head in the oven every year.
Yeah.
And like, it's okay, make a Sylvia Plath crack, that's fine, but
right.
but I think she meant it. I know she yeah. meant it. And I think that comes into play with postpartum conversations too. It's after. In my experience, friends of mine that have experienced that tend to talk about it with the second child.
Right.
You know, someone I know said, this child was much easier because I started antidepressants the day after I got home from the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. So they recognize that reality, right? And so no longer are we joking.
Right. But did not acknowledge it the first child. So for 2 or 3 years, there was no discussion of that.
Right.
Until
right.
It's like, I don't know if that comes from a sense of we tend to be socialized to not want to worry people. Like, I've got it under control. It's fine. So I won't mention that I almost, you know, did something horrible or that I was in a dark place until I'm well clear of it, which is a disturbing trend.
It is because you don't know how deep and dark it can get. Yeah. Right. And I think you're exactly right that resonates, that's part of the reason that we wait is we don't want to worry people. And again, we're talking pretty broadly sure. gender wise, but yeah. I think women are more acculturated to be caretakers and mm-hmm. not to be taken care of. And so that idea might not resonate very loudly with them. So they might yeah. wait until the crisis or the pseudo crisis yeah. has passed.
So there's almost two tracks of this, that whereas a woman or a girl might be more likely to seek help,
mm-hmm.
talking about it, which is what we need to happen in order to shift the conversation and shift the culture. Not so much.
Mm. Correct.
See, we always pick these topics, and as we start to unpack them, they get very, very nuanced and very, very complicated very quickly. So we're talking with Dr. John Duffy. We will be right back on the Saturday Night Special and 1 second after this break.
I fell in love again.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one topic and talk about it all evening. And tonight, that topic is mental health. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And anyone who's looked at any news outlet lately, felt the very contentious political environment that we're in, no matter how you voted, I think we can all agree with on that. You know, there's stress levels that are up, and there's a lot going on. People are anxious. People are fearful. People are stressed out. And in our very highly connected world where everyone is very busy, perhaps even chronically busy, it's a thing. It's real. So as much taboo is still around it, I figured a night talking about it very straightforwardly and sorting through it would do us all a lot of good. So that brings us to now. And we have our friend Dr. John Duffy in studio with us, because anytime we talk about the things that make us tick, we bring him in to talk about things because he knows what's what. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about language yeah. and how we talk about it, how men and women talk about getting help differently, and how we talk about it after the fact. But I want to bring up something else, and I know there's going to be people listening that are just going to roll their eyes and go, oh, this is political correctness. But again, the rates of all of these things we're talking about are going up. It's not going down. People are not getting better. They're getting worse. And so we got to do something.
There's no doubt about it. Societally, right. stress is going up, right. and every single category of mental illness is increasing.
Yes.
Yes.
So if tweaking our language a little bit helps some people out, why would we not want to do that? So I want to talk, though, about words that we use a little too casually. In particular, we throw around the word crazy a lot.
Right.
We say, man, I had a crazy day. Mm-hmm. The line at Starbucks is crazy long. Okay. I think we all do that a little bit. But sometimes we also name particular diagnoses. I'm thinking especially of ADD and OCD.
Those come up so easily.
So
roll
easily.
Off the tongue, right? Yeah. Absolutely.
I hear people say, wait, say that again. I'm so ADD. No, I just wasn't paying attention to you.
Right, right.
That's what I meant. Or, oh, I'm really OCD about my purse. Don't touch it.
Right.
I think we are perhaps undermining the plight of people who legitimately suffer from OCD and ADD.
I agree wholly. I think we have to be really thoughtful. And again, you know, right, I think we can be easily accused, you and I right now, of being, you know,
policing
overly,
language.
Right. And draining all fun out of the way
there
we use language.
There are those two buzzkills again.
Right. yet. These, with somebody, you know, and I sit across from people who suffer from these disorders frequently, and when somebody uses this language in a cavalier way, it is hurtful, and there's this element of shame they feel. Like there's another layer that they feel like, ooh, it's effectively somebody mm-hmm. telling them, you can't talk to me about this. You know what I mean? Because yeah. I might mock it, or I might feel like, oh, I feel the same way. You know what I mean? Because I lose my wallet all the time, you know? So, you know, I'm definitely got some ADD too. And it's like, ooh, yeah, that's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Right. So there's an opportunity for understanding, but there's enormous opportunity for misunderstandings when we're overly light about these topics.
What makes us do that?
You know, I think part of it is that, you know, just the it's become a common part of the vernacular. I think, you know, we joke about it online and we'll take this little diagnostic element and blow it up. I think it's also, though, our discomfort overall with mental illness. You know what I mean? And so I think it kind of like lifts the taboo off of talking about it in a way by making it a non-issue altogether, right? Mm. You know, it almost makes it as if there is no real ADD that people suffer. There's no OCD that people suffer. I'm depressed today because it's dark out, it's gloomy out, you know, not recognizing or maybe ignoring entirely the fact that some people are really out there really suffering this stuff.
Yeah. I'm guilty of this too. I do the same thing. I mean, sometimes if I'm trying to say I'm upset, I'm not that upset, but I'm upset, I'll say I'm not going to jump out the window or anything, but I'm just saying this is irritating.
Yeah.
That's not fair.
No.
I don't really mean that. I mean, of course, I'm not going to actually jump out of the window.
Right.
But I don't mean to joke about someone who perhaps is on a literal edge or ledge and is really thinking of taking their lives.
And it's hard to conceptualize, unless this is your stock and trade like it is mine, that all day, every day, there are people suffering.
Yeah.
Just about everything we talk about, you know, even as we talk now, I'm thinking like, wow, there's somebody out there with ADD and I hope we're not stepping over the line and making, you know, upsetting them in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So early in the show, I kicked it off with the opening monologue and I was talking about the numbers.
Uh-huh.
And it's 43.7 million Americans. That's a ton of people. And it's, if we look at all the states around us right now and our own, it's more than that.
Right.
If we take Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and Indiana, like put them all together, and that's only about roughly 39 million people. And we're talking about 43 million people. So the population of all those states, that's so many. And with all of this rising, what, in your mind, what is it going to take? Is it a combination of opening dialogue and releasing the taboo and something else, or what is it? Where do we go with all this?
Yes. You know, because I would argue that even though you draw this map and you picture like, okay, people in all these states, I still think the numbers are understated.
Mm,
you know, I really
fair.
Do.
Yeah.
I think that, and so I think there are more people suffering. So I think the more we talk about this stuff, the more we recognize, oh, there are people in my family tree, in my immediate family, down the hall at work, you know, that I know, my close friends have suffered something mm-hmm. or their spouse or their best friend, you know, like, and we don't know that if we're not talking about it. But the more we talk about it, the more you get the nods like, oh, yeah, you know, that I've had that too. Or mm-hmm. somebody I know has had that too, you know, and I'm finding that more and more and more. I in my work, in the podcast that I do where we talk about mental illness, a lot of people are just responding with, oh, thank goodness, there's somebody mm-hmm. who feels like I do out there. That's one thing I like about social media with regard to this.
Yeah.
I don't like everything about social media
sure.
with regard to this.
Sure.
But that you know, I think there's a lot of people who can look out there, find a group and not feel isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like, okay, I'm not the only one suffering this thing that
yeah.
I pictured being alone on.
Well, and as we talk about language evolving to support a healthier climate for these kind of conversations, if you think back a few generations, I mean, we all have a relative that someone said, probably described as eccentric.
Right.
Right?
Oh,
When in fact, perhaps, or quirky. You know, or maybe so-and-so was a little different. But in fact, like now you would say something very different. And there's an example of how language has evolved to support us a little more, so we can talk about these things a little more openly. Because I think even maybe my parents and grandparents' age, like, that wasn't, you wouldn't necessarily go get help for being eccentric. You would just sort of suffer that person.
Absolutely. And if I'm being, you know, if I'm being fair and honest, I remember being a kid and my grandmother, Grandma Duffy, was quirky and odd and hysterical sometimes, mm-hmm. and went away sometimes, you know? Oh. So, you know, only as an adult and a psychologist do I learn, like, oh, she actually had a psychiatric hospitalization. Okay.
Hmm.
Now I know. I can live with that, you know? And it takes that taboo away.
Yeah.
And if we go back far enough, we just didn't have names for a lot of these things.
And it was so shameful.
Exactly.
There was so much shame attached to it that I don't think is dissolved. Otherwise, we wouldn't be even here tonight having this conversation.
Exactly.
I think there's still some of that.
Yeah.
That I think it ranges a huge range of things, even into things like dementia and Alzheimer's with elderly. My grandmother has Alzheimer's, and when it first started to happen, there was a great deal of effort to explain away.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just had a bad day. Mm-hmm. No, I'm just tired. She did not, as if somehow saying it was to submit to it.
Such a good point. I mean, that's my initial contact with a lot of my clients begins with that. Like, mm-hmm. I think we're just in a little episode here, but we'll get past it. Not accepting that maybe we've
this
really
might be
got
a thing.
Yeah, this might be a thing.
Yeah.
And then if it's a thing, we'll manage the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That it could be like a lifelong thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, lots of things to discuss on this topic. We're talking with Dr. John Duffy. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. And tonight's topic is mental health, because May is Mental Health Awareness Month. But also, there have been some high-profile suicides in the news lately. There's lots of data out there about stress and anxiety on the rise, about suicide rates rising. There's a lot going on. And in our very connected, always on, always moving around kind of world, it's looking like it's going to keep going up unless we change the course of things. So Dr. John Duffy is here with us, regular contributor to this program, and we bring him in here anytime we need to understand how our minds work. And so we've been talking a lot about language here and just the narratives around it, especially all that taboo and all that stigma. I want to, before you leave, though, I definitely want to bring up something else that's kind of on the horizon, and that is how the White House has picked a mental health czar, and who is a very polarizing figure, and we don't need to get into all of that. But in it, there's a piece in the New York Times about it that points out a really interesting thing. And I think perhaps this feeds into this narrative. And that is the difference and debate even between kind of the medical model of psychiatry being about drugs and hospital treatment versus the more psychosocial community part, right? That is about care and support in your community from friends and family and peers and services, things like that. It seems like those two things should work together, but my guess is that they're really not, given the debate between the two.
Too often we end up working with one end of that model or the other, right? So we're either working through medicine to try to manage symptoms, or we work that psychosocial model, community mental health model, to try to alleviate symptoms that way. And yet there is ample research to suggest that it's the combination of these two methods that usually works best in alleviating mental health symptoms. And yet the part of the problem with the idea of the czar is that it focuses more on that medical model. And to my thinking, that psychosocial therapeutic model, that community mental health model, and building community around people who are suffering, that's what creates long-term change. You know, I usually think of, for clients of mine, I think of medicine as a portal to good therapy. You know, in other words, if I'm working with somebody who is struggling to such an extent that we really can't do good work together, I usually suggest a psychiatric evaluation and some medication.
Hmm.
But short of that, if we can get our work done through therapy and through family and community support, I prefer that route.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and it seems like this very you know, if this medical czar or this mental health czar skews towards the medical model, it seems like it will put even more of a rift in this, in the way we talk and think about this, because it will be reserved, not reserved, but it'll be kind of this idea of you only need this if you, in certain circumstances. So there, it seems like there's a whole swath of people that could, you know, through behavioral therapy or talk therapy, could deal with a situation. I'm thinking in particular of like grief.
Yes.
Something like that, that is relatively temporary, that you, you know, you go to therapy, you work it out as best you can, and you move forward, as opposed to like a long-term thing you need medication for the rest of your life. It seems like those things will be minimized that don't require medication.
Really well put, right? The metric when government gets too involved in these things is you're not suffering enough to have needs, you know? And that's what worries me a lot is, you know, if that's your metric, then you're waiting for, you know, symptoms to arise that are severe enough. And that happens, you know.
Sure.
But if we can catch people when their level of functioning is not wildly inhibited, then we can usually modulate things before it gets to the point where it's so severe. So even from a fiscal point of view, you know, really focusing on that psychosocial piece can be far, far less expensive and drive fewer crises in people's lives than working strictly with a medical model.
Yeah. And I'm thinking in particular of cases of addiction, because so often there's an underlying thing. And if, say, that underlying thing was recognized as valid and dealt with, perhaps it wouldn't have escalated to the point of, you know, a fatality or of an overdose or, you know, something like that. Or not an overdose, but just, you know, an addiction that's run out of control and destroyed a family or something.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, with addictions, we often talk about dual diagnoses, right? So rarely will you find an addiction that just stands alone. Oh, I'm just an alcoholic. No, normally there is another mental health disorder that is paired with that, right? So to your point, if you can treat both at the same time before you hit some crisis point, some acme, then you can really mitigate hospitalization or long-term rehabilitation. And that's doable. I've seen that happen, and I've seen the opposite happen as well, which is distressing.
Sure.
Yeah.
So as we're winding down the hour here, I wonder too, often we say, if you are having these thoughts or whatever, get help. It's just that kind of this couched phrase, get help. How do you really break that down? I mean, if someone is like listening right now and going, I know someone that needs my help. I don't know what to do or say. It might be awkward. Or if someone themselves is going, okay, fair enough. Maybe I need to deal with this now. What's the first thing you Google? I mean, that seems like such an obvious question, but it's complicated. There's insurance or no insurance things to tangle with. There's sometimes there is a little bit of shame attached to it, I imagine. So there's probably like, do I want people in my community to know I'm doing this?
Right.
You know, how do you even navigate that notion of getting help?
It's really tricky because you hear a lot of people say like finding good help is really, really difficult. And I wish I could say, no, I don't think that's true, but I really do. So I usually encourage people to find somebody who is who you really trust to help walk you through or walk with you through the process of getting help.
Because like it's a trusted friend or family member.
A trusted friend or family member, yes. Not somebody who's necessarily... I rarely does somebody just call a mental health professional out of the blue. I mean, I suppose that would be ideal.
Sure.
But I don't expect people to just do that. I think there's anxiety around that, you know, and I think that's a tough thing to do, especially if you've never done it. You feel like, you know, boy, I don't know what questions to ask, and I understand that. But if you have somebody walk that path with you, you can start by Googling, you know, community mental health centers in your area and just talk to somebody a little bit about like, here's what I'm going through. You can be anonymous and they will allow you to be anonymous. And here's what I'm suffering. Here's what I'm going through. What do you think my next steps ought to be? You know, but definitely reach out and talk to somebody. And I know that sounds so cliche and so taboo, But to there is no need today in this day and age with medicine where it is, with the state of therapy, my profession where it is, there is no need to suffer in long-term any psychiatric diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now there, technology has done some really interesting things. There's even text and app-based therapy programs. And there's we're a little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with someone who runs a text crisis line, so you can be on the bus, whatever, and just, hey, I need a minute, I need help here.
And that, if nothing else, that works. I've worked with people who have gotten to my couch through that app.
How interesting.
Yes.
Well, so there are options, there are things. So listen to him. He knows what he's talking about. Start there. Start Googling for mental health resources in your community, if that's something that you would like to explore. As ever, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Duffy. It always goes by so fast.
It does.
There's always a million other things that we we could be talking about. We just need to be on for 8 hours.
Right.
That's what needs to happen, because no one would get bored of that.
Of course not.
Right. Well, we're going to take a break and get you the news and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation about mental health here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for sticking with us and thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with us. Always grateful to you for doing that. So as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening long. And as the show goes on, the topic reveals itself to be a lot more nuanced than we realize at the top of the show. And tonight that topic is mental health, because May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And there are a lot of headlines and a lot of people on social media talking about, oh, these headlines are so scary and I'm so stressed out. And in our very connected world, always on kind of culture where busyness is prized, if not chronic, right? There's a lot going on. And certainly the data supports that We're not improving much. We're not helping ourselves in regards to mental health, because almost across the board, all the data we're looking at from the CDC and from Mental Health America and all these other places, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, all these places are reporting these numbers are increasing. And we also, a piece of that, a part of that conversation is on the heels of two recent high-profile suicides of Aaron Hernandez, former New England Patriots player, and of Chris Cornell, the musician, just about a week ago. And so we're joined now by Inger Burnett Ziegler from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Welcome to the program, Inger.
Thank you, Amy, so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to join us and help us make sense of all this, because when we talk about suicide, I think sometimes we talk around it. It seems like there's still a big taboo around it. There's still, the same reaction every time. The how could I have missed this? How could we have not known? Why didn't he or she say something? But I have to look back and rewind a little to when Robin Williams, when he committed suicide. I feel like things changed a little bit, not as much as they needed to, but it seemed like there was a shift. Did you get that sense?
Well, I think that, as you've been talking about earlier on the show, that the conversations around mental illness are certainly increasing. There's more dialogue about the prevalence of mental illness in the general population, and I think some increasing recognition of mental illness as a health problem that needs to be addressed. With that being said, there is still a significant amount of stigma surrounding mental illness, and I think that that's particularly prevalent when we start talking about suicide. So while some may be willing to recognize some feelings of depression and anxiety, potentially there is a lot more taboo when talking about suicide. And I think that that really plays out when looking at the suicides of Hernandez and Cornell, in that friends and family that were around them report being very surprised that these suicides occurred. And particularly in the case of Cornell, his wife is resisting the idea that it was a suicide. And while we don't really know the particulars of what happened, she has made some statements of being quite unhappy that this is being discussed as a suicide. And so whether or not it was a suicide or not, I think that that is an important example of some of the feelings that family members might endure when discussing the potential of a suicide of a family member.
Yeah, yeah. She had that statement that said, oh, no, we were just talking about plans for Memorial Day weekend. We were going to travel. There's no way he knew what he was doing.
Right. And, you know, it's not uncommon for family members to miss the signs. I think for those who are not kind of intimately involved in working with the mentally ill, we can have a tendency to minimize some of the symptoms, thinking that it's a phase that might just pass, that someone is just feeling down, they're going through a hard time. And those same thoughts can make it more difficult for people to engage in treatment and in turn a surprise when someone unfortunately does take steps to end their life.
Yeah. So in your work as a clinical psychologist and then academically as a professor at Northwestern, are you, when we're looking at this big topic and we're looking at, okay, what are those preventative steps? How do we have these conversations? It seems like there's probably a tendency to almost, I don't want to overreact. I don't want to make something out of nothing. I don't want to bring it up. Or the one I feel like we hear a lot is, I don't want it to be awkward.
Right. So I think that that's a sentiment that comes up among friends and family members. Friends and family members don't really know how to broach the conversation. They don't want to make the other person feel uncomfortable. I think as mental health professionals, we're trained to kind of, you know, ask empathetic yet direct questions about what individuals might be experiencing. And many times I've noticed that people really do. They are waiting to be asked. They're in such despair, and part of them likely wants some help. And so you asking can be giving them permission to talk about these feelings that they may not feel safe or comfortable with talking to friends or family members about. When talking, you know, sometimes I have people outside of the professional setting asking me, what should you do if you think someone is thinking about death or dying? And I advise them just to, you know, ask the person directly, are you having thoughts of death or dying? And making it a comfortable place for to kind of open up that conversation around them. With that being said, you know, even in the context of therapy, sometimes people don't want to tell you. Particularly people that have been engaged in therapy for long periods of time, they may know that asking that the answer to that question might land them in the hospital. And despite whatever feelings of significant despair or hopelessness they may be experiencing, they also simultaneously may not want to be in the hospital and as a result may not disclose those symptoms to their provider.
Sure.
So it can be very complicated and sensitive terrain to try to navigate.
Sure, sure. But I like the idea of asking very directly because I think the inclination is probably, hey, are you okay? Or hey, how are you? Which may not open that conversation as effectively.
Right. Absolutely. I think that most people in my guesstimate would not respond to a general question in that way of, no, I'm thinking about harming myself.
Is there do you feel like there's a common thing people with very good intentions do to try to help someone that in fact is not helpful or maybe even harmful?
I think that minimizing the issue can be harmful. And so things like, it'll get better. It's not that serious. There are people that have worse problems than you. Those types of things that kind of minimize whatever that individual's perception of the other individual's problem may be can really not open and validate wherever they are emotionally at that particular time. So a lot of validation, a lot of, reflection and recognition and understanding and empathy and allowing the space for them to feel whatever they're feeling. And then actually supporting that person and making the connection to getting treatment, I think is critically important. And that can be done by saying, you know, you can get help for what you're experiencing right now. You don't have to endure this level of depression, anxiety, suffering that you're experiencing right now. And maybe even asking, how can I support you in that?
I think that's a very powerful question. Just what can I do for you? How can I support you? Before then, in the first hour, we were talking with Dr. John Duffy, who was talking about the idea of having an advocate with you if you feel like you want to get help, of having a trusted friend or family member, like, help me navigate this, which sounds like a very powerful tool.
It is a powerful tool. And the unfortunate thing is navigating the health service system is complicated and difficult for anybody. And it can become even more complicated when talking about navigating it with regard to mental health services, which is often unclear, particularly with insurance, what's covered, what's not covered. Sometimes you can go to a certain provider for health care and you can't get your mental health care there. Mm-hmm. And so, and particularly in Illinois, there's a dearth of community-based mental health services that are available. So even if you have kind of a trusted advocate to help you navigate, that person can be good for emotional support and potentially also good for kind of the technical support in navigating the system. But that can really be challenging for anyone.
Right. I mean, it can be frustrating just to figure it out if you've got like the flu.
Absolutely.
Much less if you're already feeling, you know, overwhelmed or despondent or something like that. I'm sure it's very difficult to navigate all that stuff because you want to throw the phone, even just calling your insurance company to ask about a flu shot or something. There's a lot to be discussed there in that part for sure.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Dr. Inger Burnett Ziegler from Northwestern University. And she is a clinical psychologist and professor there at Feinberg School of Medicine, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for being with us. Tonight we're talking about mental health. Not only is May Mental Health Awareness Month, but we've recently had a couple of very high-profile suicides in the news of Chris Cornell and Aaron Hernandez that have brought this conversation up again. I feel like it came up a lot after Robin Williams' suicide several years ago, but it's come back up again of lots of how do we miss the signs? How do we not see this coming? Oh, so young, all of these things that we say when people take their own lives. So to help us talk about this, we have with us Dr. Inger Burnett Ziegler. She is from Northwestern University's. She is a professor at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. She's also a Public Voices Fellow with the Op-Ed Project and a clinical psychologist. She does all the things. You can see why we have brought her in to share her knowledge. So we've been talking about kind of the way we talk about suicide and think about it, and in particular, how to help somebody if you believe someone is thinking of taking their own lives. I want to shift to another thing that's been in the news lately, and that is this show, 13 Reasons Why, whatever that is, right?
13 Reasons Why, a new series on Netflix.
Yes, lots of people talking about that, and it's very controversial, and it's sparked a lot of kind of think pieces and op-eds because it is, it's about this young woman, and she has created kind of like a suicide note, but on tape, to the 13 people that she felt caused her to take her own life. So this narrative has emerged quickly about glamorizing suicide to young people, and should you let your teen watch it or not? And there's some people that say absolutely it will open a dialogue, and some people saying absolutely not. It will make them think it is a glamorous thing to do. It is fraught, this show.
Right. So the show is really kind of putting on display angst of an adolescent woman who has committed suicide, and she's kind of leaving behind her legacy of all of the people that contributed to her despair in the, I think, final year before she took her life. Some of the, I guess, important discussion topics that have come out of this series is the impact of bullying in shaming adolescent girls. So as a psychologist kind of looking at it, I do think that the series does open discussion about the ways in which body shaming, shaming related to kind of sexual development of adolescents can really have a significant impact on the mental health of a young girl. Alternatively, I think some of the contention around the show is that it kind of displays her as leaving this legacy behind. And that, I think, is being interpreted as glamorous. This is her legacy note that she's leaving behind to kind of shame and hurt the other people that contributed to her despair.
And kind of have this ultimate power over them,
exactly,
in a sense. Which I could see a young person going, oh, I would like to stick it to that bully or to that person.
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, when we do suicide screenings to assess the likelihood of the risk of an individual committing suicide, the intention for revenge is one of the questions that clinicians will sometimes ask. And that's a theme that kind of is pervasive throughout the 13 Reasons Why series, is it kind of has this sense of she's trying to get revenge on these people that have hurt her by leaving them these tapes. And they actually do experience quite a bit of discomfort and despair,
sure,
listening,
yeah,
listening to the ways in which they led to her demise.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not, right? If
right.
you receive something like that, you're like, I can't make amends here. This is very
right.
final. Well, revenge is an interesting piece of that, because I think that's one piece that gets left out of suicide conversations a lot. We don't hear about the revenge part. We hear about despair. We hear about, you know, even addiction and things like that that could have led to this, someone taking such a step. But revenge is an interesting piece that's interesting that's in a screening like that.
Yeah, revenge and hopelessness are questions that are asked in some screening. So this seeing suicide as the only way to escape the pain and suffering that one is experiencing at that particular time, as measured by hopelessness, and revenge towards other people that have kind of caused you harm.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's associated with something that's considered superficial suicide
sure.
attempts. But it's a question that's asked in screening nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, and so because this show has opened this conversation, this show, 13 Reasons Why, what is the right way to talk to young people about suicide? If you're a parent, maybe you don't suspect they're thinking about it, but you just want to have that conversation going. How do you even open that?
Well, I think similar to how one opens the conversation with adults, I think that sometimes, particularly when we're talking about adolescents, there's a risk of minimizing what they're experiencing as adolescent angst.
Mm-hmm.
And so noticing that there are emotional stages that adolescents do go through in a normal developmental process, but also being mindful of the fact that can start to skew towards being unhealthy. And as parents, kind of having your radar attuned to that, and again, directly opening the dialogue about the mood state of the adolescent and allowing a space for conversation around that. I think particularly in this stage of social media, the risk has likely heightened because we see a lot of conversation of adolescents in particular discussing these types of very serious symptoms and mood states on social media. We also see social media as a tool to seriously shame adolescents, and that can have very real consequences to it. And so I think that is a reason to really take what adolescents are experiencing in terms of their mood very seriously.
Yeah, I'm thinking in particular around social media bullying with young
mm-hmm.
people. And some of the things you see, particularly in cases that have escalated, that have become headlines, you see language in it that I think for a young person would be hard to decipher, particularly the word everyone, like everyone thinks you're this, mm-hmm. everyone's saying this. If you're a young person, if you're in high school, let's say, and someone says, everyone thinks you're a jerk or whatever, everyone does feel like everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like everybody mm-hmm. in the entire universe and all of Facebook and everyone. Whereas an adult, you can be like, who's everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Like you, and that's
mm-hmm.
it? Okay, mm-hmm. right? It's much easier to compartmentalize that and say, well, this is just a ridiculous person trying to be mean to me, mm-hmm. even though it could be hurtful to an adult. I think it's easy for young people to not have that ability yet to put it in perspective of how
mm-hmm.
how big a threat is, or how you know, how far reaching a rumor could be or something like that.
Absolutely. And I think at that stage of development, that's normal. You know, that adolescents see the world as kind of revolving around them, as their experience is being kind of permanent. They can't they can't kind of foresee that things will change and things will get better. And sometimes suicide is discussed as a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And I think that that can be particularly salient and dangerous when talking about adolescents.
Yeah, yeah. So we've opened a lot of envelopes here as we've been talking about this topic that is such a serious one. But I really like the message of direct questions instead of how's it going, but really, are you having these thoughts? I think that's really important. I think that's important in anything. I mean, I'm always in favor of very, very specific and radical kind of honesty and direct questions and that sort of thing. So as we kind of back up, as unfortunately the clock is running down here on this conversation, as we think about someone trying to help someone in need, in addition to helping them and supporting them emotionally and letting them know that you're there for them, what are other steps that can be taken? You know, I think there's perhaps the phase where you might suspect something, but then there's the phase where you know something is up versus, and then on all the way down to, I have a feeling this is about to happen. What are those other steps in between that?
So I think direct questioning is a good place to start. If you're noticing symptoms of depression or other mental illness and don't think that it's necessarily serious, however you determine that to be, connecting the individual to primary care is a really good place to start as a gateway to getting to specialized mental health treatment. Some of the signs to look for in terms of determining the threshold of when the severity is starting to increase is isolation, substance use, particularly a change in life circumstance, so the loss of a job, the loss of a relationship, withdrawal from friends and family. And if you have real specific indicators that someone might be at high risk of suicide, or they have actually answered your direct questioning, letting you know that they're thinking of harming themselves, then calling the police or taking them to the emergency room absolutely is an option.
Yeah. What about, if you look around your house, say you have a member of your family, you know, there's obvious things like if you have a weapon, you might want to put that away, or prescription medication that could be harmful. Are there other things that people should be thinking about limiting access to?
Right. So the things that you've named, leftover medication, prescription medication, knives, guns, medication, suffocation, and arms are the most common methods by which people do complete suicide. So anything that would allow somebody to hurt themselves via those methods should absolutely be removed.
Okay, well, you've given us a lot to think about, lots of useful information, but more than the thing that sticks out the most to me is the really direct and specific language. I think that's really, really important in all things, but in particular in this area where the stakes are indeed so very high. Inger Burnett Ziegler, thank you so much for being with us. We will follow you on social media, do all of those things, and we will talk with you again soon.
Thank you, Amy.
Certainly. All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news, and we will be back for more of this conversation. We'll be talking with a supervisor from a crisis text line, and then later with the president of the Mental Health America Illinois chapter. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. This is the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us, sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. Always grateful to you for that. Well, as ever, we pick one big topic on this show and we talk about it all evening long. And that topic tonight is mental health. We picked that not only because May is Mental Health Awareness Month, but also because we've seen some high-profile suicides in the news lately. And a lot of people on social media and around talk about being very stressed out with all these headlines that are rather grim. So looking at the data supports that really all of these things are on the rise: stress, anxiety, depression, all kinds of mental illness of all varieties. So we're talking about that tonight, and we've had a lot of people joining us to help us talk about different aspects of that topic and to think through not only how we talk about it, but what we do when it is affecting us or someone that we love. And so let's continue that conversation. We're joined now by Becca Ross, who's a supervisor at Crisis Text Line. She's also a licensed clinical social worker. Hi, Becca. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. Well, so talk us through the work that you do at your organization, because I'm very interested in the role that technology is playing. For the longest time, there was kind of like hotlines and crisis hotlines and things like that. But technology has changed, and text messaging and even apps that are kind of therapy on demand and help when you need it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a very exciting time and a good time to meet people where they're at with their mental health. And so at Crisis Text Line, we're a free text line for people all over the nation, 24/7. Anybody in crisis can text in. You just do 741-741 right up the left side of the keypad and text in, and you'll be connected with a highly trained crisis counselor. And so kind of how it works is when somebody texts in, they are entered into our queue, and our queue has an algorithm that will rank them based on severity. So this is kind of where technology comes into play and really doing some innovative stuff here with people coming to us. So if we have somebody in our queue that says, I just broke up with my boyfriend, and then somebody comes and says, I'm suicidal, the one that says I'm suicidal is getting bumped up to the top of the queue so we can get to them quickly.
How interesting that, yeah, that, right? That you have that technology available to you.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so we're always kind of assessing that and learning and growing. But our data right now says that people who, we call those conversations code orange. We want to get to them quickly. They're high risk. We know that they are. And typically right now we get to those texters within about a minute, which is pretty awesome that we can respond that quickly and get them the support and help that they need. And then eventually, of course, still getting to all the texters that come through our queue. And then once they get through the queue, they're connected with one of our, we have almost 3,200 crisis counselors that answer the line. And those people are highly trained. There's you have to be 18 older, background check, and then there's a 34-hour training that's very extensive with role plays and assessments by trainers, and then they eventually get on our platform. And really our goal is to take somebody from a heated moment, their crisis, to a cool calm. So we are not we're not therapy. We don't take the place of therapy. That's not our intention. We're trying to de-escalate a crisis situation and then hopefully connect people with long-term services. And that's kind of the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so what is the range of crisis there? Because, if code orange is, someone's who's thinking of hurting themselves, what is the other end of or is really all of it welcome?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that is really important when we're talking about mental health in general and reducing stigma and in our service, that crisis is however it is experienced by the person coming to us. So we would never turn anybody away. And so our issues really range from depression, anxiety, relationship issues, self-harm, I mean, anything that you can think of, we've seen it and we work with it. And that's kind of the nice thing about our model of intervention, is that since we're not therapy, we can really work with and de-escalate anybody with any issue and support them in that way.
And again, that's 741-741, as you said, just right up the side of your keypad on your phone there.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
what are the numbers that you're seeing? Do you know what is the volume of text that you're receiving on a given day?
Yeah, so this is really exciting. Just a little history that we launched in 2013, so just a few years ago, and without any marketing, within 4 months, Crisis Text Line was being used by all 295 area codes in the United States. So huge need. This really just took off. And today we're doing about right around 60,000 conversations per month. And over our lifetime, 38 million messages have been exchanged since 2013.
38 million messages. Yes. That's really significant. And 60,000 a month. That's very significant. And so I'm so glad that you're doing that work. That's so very important that that many people are getting the help that they need and that they are taking that initiative to reach out to receive it.
Go ahead. Oh, sorry. So I was just going to say that the exciting thing about this is that most people have a phone in their hand. They're used to text messaging. 75% of the people who come to us are under the age of 25. They're familiar and comfortable with texting. So they can text us from the bathroom of their school when they're getting bullied or in the moment of a crisis, which is really significant and exciting to move the field in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, that way you don't have to necessarily take time out of your life. You can be on the bus. Mm-hmm. You can reach out and this is 24/7.
Yep, 24/7, every 365, we're always here.
That's so wonderful. And do you see generally, are there patterns that you see? Are there spikes in maybe day of the week or time of the year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So we definitely have days that are a little busier, and we're sitting on the largest data set of mental health in the nation, which is unbelievable because our numbers are so high. And so we have open data. We have a website called crisistrends.org, and so you can see all the different patterns and data that are out there. And that's kind of our effort to help create services that are needed and kind of meet people where they're at right now. But for instance, eating disorders, we see the most eating disorder issues on Sundays. So we kind of know when we're on the platform and the crisis counselors, they're a little bit more trained and developed on eating disorders on Sundays. And so we've noticed some patterns. We know that 30% of our texters have either mentioned depression or suicide as an issue that they're texting in with. And then, of course, we see huge spikes based on what's going on in the country. And so with the recent kind of in the news suicides, we definitely see spikes around that. Anytime there's hate crimes, things of that nature. And then also political issues, too. During the election, we saw a huge spike of people texting in as well.
No, I'm sure. I mean, just sitting watching Twitter during that that campaign and election cycle, and then still now as new stories develop and new things come out of the White House, certainly you see people reacting with fear or outrage or whatever. You see a lot of very strong emotional reactions, and I get the sense too that there's like a fatigue that kind of makes one thin skinned after a while, after a lot of that kind of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. We see all the feelings around that, and it's definitely something that our crisis counselors are trained on and able to support them in that moment.
Wonderful work that you're doing. Becca Ross from Crisis Text Line. Again, that website, crisistrends.org, there's open data there. It's really, really interesting. A lot of good information there. And again, if you want to save this, it's 741-741. We'll put you in that queue and in touch with someone who can help you if you are in crisis. Becca, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Have a good evening.
Good night.
All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking with the president of the board of the Mental Health America Illinois chapter. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight as we all night have been talking about the topic of mental health. It is one that is talked about anecdotally a lot on social media, and it's certainly been in the news lately with a couple of high-profile suicides. And also, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and so that is why we've chosen this topic to talk about it all night. There's also a lot of data that suggests that mental health and stress and anxiety, all of these things are on the rise. We're not we're not fixing it. In fact, it's raising up. It's getting more and more. So we want to talk about this to try to make a little bit of sense of it, and think about the way we talk about it and think about it and see if there's something we can do a little bit better. Joining us now is Joyce Gallagher, who is president of the board of the Illinois chapter of Mental Health America. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Amy, and thank you so much for highlighting mental health.
Oh, well, my pleasure. I think it's so very important to talk about. And earlier in the show, we were talking a lot about how we talk about it, the language that we use, and what we could perhaps change in order to shift that taboo and kind of release some of the stigma.
Well, actually, Mental Health America was started by Jane Addams at Hull House in 1908. So we've been around a long time, and basically it's a volunteer organization. So we are at the forefront of working with people that need to speak our language and need to speak clear language about, you know, what is affecting them and what we can do to advocate for them and to educate them. And so that's our mission, and it will continue on.
And I have to say, wonderful data on your website. There's so much good information there, and I encourage everyone to go take a look at it. There's really a lot of good stuff there. So in your mind and within your organization, what is the biggest issue that just keeps coming up again and again? In your mind, maybe the biggest hurdle we have to overcome right now when it comes to mental health?
Well, it is legitimately the stigma of mental illness and how we can educate people to be partners with those that are suffering from mental illness. They suffer not only from the illness, but from the stigma associated with it. And so our education campaign is to bring that awareness to the ground level, to each of us. And as a purely volunteer group, that's what we attempt to do. And I think the most difficult part of it is to realize that most social ills are untreated mental illness. So when you look at homelessness or domestic violence or substance abuse, many times, you know, police officers will be involved or social workers will be involved, but the person themselves is not treated. And when that happens, you know, they are isolated from the community and they become part of the problem instead of the community trying to help them and have the community be part of the solution.
That's right. And we see that so much in news stories as we learn about someone who has been accused of a crime. So often that is thrown out, that this person suffers from some kind of mental illness. Sometimes it's vaguely written. It just says mental illness. And sometimes it's vaguely known that we don't know exactly what the issue is. But I think that kind of, it's interesting how that plays in the narrative, particularly of high profile crimes, because it almost, on one hand, it makes people go, oh, well, that's why, or that's this. And it I think it feeds into that stigma to a great deal.
Well, Sheriff Dart is on our advisory board, and Dr. Nika Jones, who is the Cook County Jail Warden, is a sitting member of our board. And I think it shows that, you know, we are at a place where our mental illness has turned into a place to jail people instead of, you know, help them move beyond the illness itself and treat the illness and get them to a place of being part of society. So that is where the stigma is. And people are afraid to, you know, admit to having the illness, and families are isolated. And I know I was watching a TV show once that affected me profoundly. The interviewer asked a woman what was the difference between her child having a mental illness or cancer, and she said casseroles, meaning that, you know, the neighbors would come if her child had cancer, but her neighbors, you know, isolated her because of her child's mental illness. And I think that is the crux of the problem. And I believe that until everyone becomes educated and becomes an advocate, this will continue. So Mental Health America invites everyone to join us, learn about mental illness, learn how you can help that person that's in your family or next to you by just becoming educated yourself. And you don't know when you're going to need that yourself, because there are many times in life where you can absorb things and all of a sudden something happens and you find yourself in need of help yourself. And if you are educated yourself, you can maybe reach out because now you have tools.
Certainly, certainly. And I think that was a very interesting point that you made about the casseroles, because I think part of probably what stops people from supporting or interacting with families who have someone suffering from a mental illness is, I think people don't want to feel awkward. They don't know what to say. So what steps would you recommend if someone knows somebody going through something like that, maybe is caretaking, where do you start that conversation?
I would start it just with the simple outreach and, you know, not discussing the situation, but literally just being present. I think that happens so many times at people's pivotal moments in their lives. They say they don't know what to say, either a death or, you know, some type of uncomfortable situation. But I think a person's presence speaks the volumes. And, you know, whether that person ever says anything, you know, or not, your mere presence is, you know, a sign to them that you've accepted them and you're there for them.
Right, right. You're not going to shun them or you know, cast them aside, that you hear them and that you see them. I think that's so very powerful. And I think, you know, earlier in the program we were talking with a clinical psychologist from Northwestern's Feinberg School who was really talking about the importance of direct language as a tool for suicide intervention. But I think that applies also to families of perhaps your first outreach is just, how are you? What's going on? But I think sometimes there's power in just, you know, naming it and saying things quite directly to people.
Right. And I think something that I've been witnessing recently with suicide families of suicide victims, that they've been, you know, pronouncing it. And that is a great comfort, not only to the family, but to those that are, you know, trying to console them, because that allows for honest exchange and honest empathy and honest love and support. And, you know, it's not a comfortable situation, but it is love. And that is basically what humans, you know, are good at. So if we just convey that love to individuals and they'll know it, I don't think we need a lot of, you know, social programs to help us. I think it's just that presence. I really do feel that.
Certainly, certainly. So if someone listening wants to be involved, I know Mental Health America Illinois is an entirely volunteer organization. How can people be involved or support your organization the best?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, our website is www.mhai.org. And as you mentioned, our website can lead them to volunteer, to be part of our organization, to donate, just even to participate in some of our programs. We have a speaker series at Hull House. We have an awesome junior board that is our legacy. So if someone's in their 20s or 30s and want to join the junior board, they can. We're always looking for good board members. So if someone is led to do that, we would love to visit with you and make that happen. So, you know, just remember that none of us is trained to do this. I mean, social workers are, but at the end of the day, we're all human. And so, you know, it is literally, you know, you are qualified if you just have the intention. So please join us.
Wonderful message. Thank you so much. And I will be sure to share a link to that website, mhai.org, on the WGN Radio website, and I'll also tweet it out through my social media. Joyce Gallagher, President of the Board of Mental Health America Illinois, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. All right. So we've covered a lot of stuff tonight. There's been a lot to this and a lot to unpack, as ever, when we pick these one big topic things and we start to dissect them. But a special thank you to all of my guests tonight who have each taken a different aspect of this. And certainly there were many other places we could go. There's lots of other things to talk about. And we couldn't possibly get to all of them in such a very big and serious topic. But messages that stand out, I think, are clear, and that is from the idea of speaking very directly to what is in front of you when confronting mental illness, when asking about someone's well-being, when checking in with people, when checking in with a caretaker. All of those things matter. And while we all want to avoid awkwardness and we sometimes don't know what to say, so we say nothing at all, I think when the stakes are this high, when we're seeing rates of suicide and rates of mental illness go up, when we have over 43 million Americans in the United States suffering from some kind of mental illness, which is more than the population of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan all put together, that's a significant number. So we need to be talking about it more, and we need to be asking each other direct questions and confronting this head on. So thank you for being with us tonight. We will see you back here next week. That does it for us. We're going to turn you over now to Dave Hoekstra, but not before we check in with news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you are an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. The news is sponsored by Waltz Food Centers. It's 9 o'clock. Here's our good friend David Jennings.